Biblical Theory of Headship, the fourth talk in a series titled Understanding Love, Sex, and Marriage, was presented by Ron Julian on October 22, 2002, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
With it is very likely that it is going to turn into something bad, and it often has. Which leads me to my next point. Although I believe in headship, I am sad to say that more often than not, the concept seems to me to have been greatly misunderstood and misused. All of us have been involved with people whose marriages are not in good shape, and I just can't tell you how often you might see the situation where a man tries to justify his own basic selfishness and lack of concern for his wife by complaining that she's not submitting to him. And frankly, although I think headship is a biblical idea, I think it would be better for us not to believe in it than to believe in it the way it has been perverted in the culture around us so often. Thirdly, I think that some of the problem with the concept is that we have spent too much time arguing about passages. You know, does 1 Corinthians 11, does headship mean this or this or that? And way too little time actually thinking about what the implications of the ideas are. I don't think that we have spent much time thinking about a biblical philosophy of authority in the first place. What does it mean that I would ever submit to someone, and on what grounds, and what are the ethics of that? So, for instance, you will find many people would describe biblical headship as the wife's supposed to do what the husband says. Well, I would argue that that's really a terrible way to describe the concept of biblical headship. That's not, it's so misleading a way to describe it that it's not really getting at it at all. I think what we need, like I say, is kind of a biblical philosophy of authority. What does it mean that I would ever be asked to submit to the will of someone else? And what is the righteous way to respond to authority of that sort? So, I don't know if this is going to be disappointing to you or surprising to you, what I'm going to do tonight, but my primary concern here is not to take you to a dozen passages and prove from them that the wife is supposed to submit to the husband. What I want to do is lay a groundwork for what I think is a biblical way of thinking about the concept of authority at all and relate it to the concept of headship. So I am going to talk about some of the passages involved a little bit. We need to do that. But my problem is I have too much to talk about tonight. So what I want to make sure I get done is to kind of lay out, here's the general idea, I think, and tell you a little bit about why I think that we should think about it that way. And then in the end, I am really leaving it to you to assess whether that in fact is a biblical way of understanding things. And you can ask questions, but I mean, in a way, I'm sort of laying out the table and say, here, okay, isn't this, in fact, what we've got? It's going to take more exploration than we can do tonight to actually determine, yes, that's it, and this, here's where it goes. I'm trying to just sort of be a helper tonight, which is all right. That's a biblical concept, actually. My last opening concept, comment that I want to make is, I know that you're not supposed to start out a talk by saying, I could be wrong. But the fact is, I feel like I need to say that in particular when it comes to this topic, I am convinced right now that the perspective that I'm going to try to present tonight is the biblical perspective. I believe in what it is I'm saying. But I want to be very upfront with you that some of the passages involved in the Bible that actually lead us to talk about this kind of stuff are actually very difficult. And they have a lot of questions that need to be resolved in them. They are very difficult passages to work with. I have heard a lot of different arguments. I have wrestled with these passages for a number of years. I've read a lot of books, people arguing one thing or another. I am not convinced by the arguments that I have heard that headship is an unbiblical concept. I think I'm on the right track as to what the Bible is saying about this stuff. Although I am aware of many arguments that would be made the other way. But I do readily admit that there are hard questions involved with this. So I hope I'm not coming across as dogmatic on this topic. There are some things that I understand from the Bible that I would insist on fairly strongly. Here I'm saying, this is how I understand it. This is how I understand what the Bible is saying, and this makes sense to me of what we find in the text. And part of it, you understand, is I'm in the same position as anyone else. I am in my 25th year of marriage, and I am trying to figure out what it means to be a husband and what it means to be married. I mean, this is something that's not an academic question. It's a question that I've been exploring for a long time. What is my responsibility as a husband? What is my wife's responsibility to me? What together are we called to do? I mean, these are not academic questions. They're very relevant questions to me. So we're in the process, my wife and I, of just trying to figure out what's this stuff all about. And I hope that what I have to say to you tonight is helpful as you try to figure out what this stuff is all about, but there's a lot to talk about. We'll continue with the topic next week. Jack is going to be talking about submission, which is very much a continuation of what I'm going to be saying tonight. In fact, I may be saying tonight what he's going to say, and which I apologize for, but I didn't know how else to do this. So, having said all of that, let's launch into it a little bit. What I want to do is try to lay out what I would say is a sound and biblical way of thinking about the concept of authority and how that relates in marriage to the concept of headship. That's what I'm seeking to do tonight, and I hope I can be helpful in doing that. Go ahead and come on up if you want. It won't bother us. You can bring some chairs up, too. We've got lots of room up here. Okay, so the fundamental idea that I'm working with, the thing that makes sense to me as I approach the question in my own life and reading the Bible about authority, is that authority goes with responsibility. You know, this is what your parents always told you. Well, it was true. They were right about this. The one who decides should be the one who is responsible. The one who decides is the one who ultimately is going to be answerable for how it turns out. That's just a basic fundamental principle of life, I would say. So you picture this situation. You have a king, and before him he has the royal architect and his 6-year-old son. And he says, I'm so proud of my 6-year-old son. He's such a bright kid that I'm going to let my kid design it, and he's going to decide what it's made of, and the whole thing. He's going to get to make all the decisions and design it and do everything. And you, royal architect, are responsible for how it turns out. You think, well, wait a minute, that's not fair. It doesn't make any sense. How can you hold him accountable when he's the guy who got to make all the decisions? Ultimately, what makes sense is that it is the one who has the responsibility, the one who's answerable in the end for how it turns out, who rightly ought to have the authority. And it only makes sense that the one who has the responsibility is the one who would make those decisions. So that's a fundamental idea for what I want to talk about tonight. Now, there is a first sort of bottom line implication of that from my perspective. Basically, each individual is responsible before God for his or her own life. And so each individual has the authority, the basic authority over his or her own life. There is this idea that runs all through the Bible. One day I will stand before God and give an answer for how I lived my life. I am going to answer for how I lived my life. You are not going to answer for how I lived my life. I'm not going to answer for how you lived your life. I am going to stand and give an account of my own existence, the choices that I made in life. So, my basic understanding, the basic stance from which I approach life is I am the authority over my own life, in the sense that I am answerable to God for my own life. Therefore, I am the one who's going to choose what I do. Not you. I don't want you to tell me what to do, because I'm not going to do it anyway, because I'm the one who's answerable, and I'm not going to tell you what to do, because you're the one who's answerable. If I have some friends and they're urging me to join them and they've decided that they want to knock over a 7-Eleven or something like that, no one says, well, it would be virtuous of you to submit to them in this situation. Of course it wouldn't be virtuous to submit to them. I am responsible for the choices I make. If they choose to knock over a 7-Eleven, well, that's their choice, and they're going to be answerable for it in the end. But there's no virtue in submitting to their choice. I understand their choice to be wrong. I don't want to be a thief. It is not my decision to do that. That's not what I want for my life. I recognize that I'm going to be answerable for the choices that I make ultimately, and that's not the direction I want to go. So, fundamentally, the fundamental bottom line truth that we're working with here is whatever our concept of leadership and authority is, it has very clear limits. It can only go so far. Because it is not possible for any other person to take responsibility for my personal decisions. I am responsible for my personal decisions, and so I can't throw them on to you and say, well, I'll just do what you say because I'll let you take the rap for it. No, I'm going to take the rap for it. I'm the one who's going to answer for my choices. So, to the extent that that is true, all authority in my life rests with me. Now, the issue is to what extent is that true? But the bottom line truth that we start with is I'm responsible for the choices that I make. This is true in church leadership. The leadership in a church is not going to stand before God and answer for what I believed and what I chose to do. I'm going to answer for that. And I would say that it is true in marriage as well. A husband is responsible before God for his own choices. A wife is responsible for her own choices. And there is this place where, even under the concept of headship, if it is indeed a biblical concept, which I think it is, no husband can tell his wife what to believe or how she's going to live her life. Those are her choices before God. He can't make them for her, so he can't ask her to submit her own personal choices to him. That's a basic bottom line truth. So, because I am responsible, because I will answer for the moral direction of my own life, I have the basic authority over my own life, and I do what I choose to do. Okay, so are we done? No concept of headship. That's it. You're responsible for yourself. Don't ever do what anybody tells you. End of story. Well, no. But the question arises then, why would I ever defer to someone else? If I'm seeking to follow God and do what is right, in what situation would I ever actually want to do one thing but do something else instead because somebody else has asked me to or desires me to or something like that? Why would that ever happen if basically I'm responsible for my choices? Well, I'm sure that we could describe this in different ways, but I want to talk about this in terms of three different situations where I might rightly and legitimately defer to someone else in the choices that I make. And that's basically what I want to talk about tonight, is these three reasons and how I want to describe them in general and then specifically how they're related to marriage. Okay, so you with me? Basically, it's my choice. It's my responsibility for my own life. So why would I ever defer to someone else? Why would I ever submit? Reason number one. Sometimes decisions must be made that affect not just the individual, but a group of people. There are choices that must be made that are not just choices that I am making about myself, but that we are making together. And sometimes, in those situations, there is someone who is responsible, who is answerable, ultimately, for what the group does. And if that's true, then I would say the person who is responsible for what the group does has authority over the group by rights. If someone is responsible for the direction the group goes, then it is right and appropriate for the group to defer to the one who is responsible. Think of an employee in a company. This is an easy concept to understand in principle. When you look at real companies with real sinful people running them, it gets more complicated. But the idea is simple enough to understand. As a supervisor who has been given the responsibility for a certain project, and this supervisor has working for him a number of people who have various jobs to do on this project. But the supervisor is the one who is answerable for whether it is successful or not. It is appropriate and right for any of those employees under the supervisor's leadership to submit to his decisions, because he is the one who is answerable. He is the one who is going to pay the price if the project is not successful. And, I mean, in most work situations, this is a pretty understandable concept, that in the end, I'm going to go in the direction that the supervisor is taking this project because he's responsible for where it goes. If it doesn't work, he's the one who is going to have to stand up and say, I was the one who led us in this direction and it didn't end up going anywhere. I think that this is relevant to our relationship with God, that there are situations where basically there is someone answerable to God for what a group of people are doing. I think this is what we see when it comes to leadership in the church. The passage that I think of in particular is Hebrews 13, verse 17, where the author of Hebrews says, "Obey your leaders and submit to them, for they keep watch over your souls as those who will give an account." Well, I understand him to be saying there that, look, in Christian groups, there are those, the elders, those who are responsible for what's getting taught and for looking out for, you know, helping to resolve conflicts and that sort of thing. Those who have a responsibility for the life of the group. Now, an elder or pastor is not responsible for the individual choices that a person makes. I cannot make another person believe the truth. I can't make another person do the right thing. And I'm not responsible before God for what they do there. In the end, they are going to answer for the choices they make. But there are these things that have to do with the direction that the group goes. What is the group going to be taught? What are we going to do together? How are we going to respond to certain situations? Are we going to build a building and, you know, all of those kinds of things? There are ultimately people who are responsible before God for, especially, I mean, I shouldn't have put the building stuff in there, especially we're talking about the spiritual direction of the church. What is this place about? And there comes this place where those who are in that position of leadership have a responsibility before God, and I think what the author of Hebrews is saying, they will have to give an account ultimately for how they led this group of people. So each individual in the church will be responsible for their own personal choices, but in addition, those who have leadership are going to be answerable for where they took things. So, I believe that the Bible is indicating that there is that same sort of dynamic at work in the relationship between husband and wife in the family. That Each individual is responsible for the personal decisions of his or her own life. The wife for her life, the husband for her life, the children for their lives. Each of them bears personal responsibility for themselves, but the husband has a prior responsibility for the life of the family. Starting with creation itself, God made Adam responsible for his own choices as a moral agent. He made Eve responsible for her own choices as a moral agent, but he gave Adam a larger responsibility for which he is responsible and for which Eve is his helper. Now, that's what I understand starting in Genesis, the picture that emerges is. So the implication of this is that in a marriage, the husband is answerable to God for the larger family unit, although each person in it is responsible for their own individual decisions within that family. That's the basic picture that I have of the relationship between husband, wife, and children in the marriage. So, now, here's where I bump up against the fact that we only have so much time to talk about all of this stuff. I apologize for this, but I'm going to do a whirlwind, here's a verse and here's a verse, kind of just to give you a brief idea of why I would say that this is so. But you have to understand my purpose here tonight. I don't want to just hit you with these passages without talking about how they fit in to the overall picture. Because I've just seen too many times. I could get up here and say, see, 1 Corinthians 11 says the husband's the head. Ephesians 5 says, see, the husband's the head. Okay, so go out there and do that. And you all scatter in a million different directions and take that in all kinds of directions that were not ever intended, I don't think. So I'm more concerned to get the fences in tonight. I want to say, this is the arena in which we're working. This is what it is about and this is what it isn't about. Which means that I've given myself not as much time to actually defend the interpretations of these passages, but this was a deliberate choice I made. So I know in the end, I'm not going to say enough to convince you that these passages ought to be taken this way, but I want you to understand the general idea of why I would take them this way. So let me just hit you with a couple of passages to think about. One of them is Ephesians chapter 5. I'm sure these are familiar passages to anyone who's ever thought about these issues at all. In chapter 5, verse 21, we have, "And be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. Wives, to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and blameless. So husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. For this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I am speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each individual among you also love his own wife, even as himself, and let the wife see to it that she respect her husband." Okay, so a couple of things I just want to point out to you here. We have in this passage the connection of the idea of Christ being the head of the church and wives being subject to their husbands. What I will not go into tonight is all of the debate. I just couldn't tell you how many articles have been written debating the word kephale in Greek, which translates head, as to what exactly the significance of it is. And here's a huge article over here that says, okay, no, it doesn't have anything to do with authority or anything like that. It means source of life or something like that. And then somebody comes along over here with another big article and says, no, that's all wet. here's the deal on what's going on with this word. And I've read so much of that kind of stuff. There's a lot of it out there. There's a never-ending supply. If you're ever looking for, like, maybe you want to wallpaper your house or something like that, and you're running out of paper, just find articles on kephale, and you'll have enough to do the whole house, I'm sure. I would argue that the arguments against the idea of headship implying authority are not good arguments, that the arguments saying that it does imply authority are better. That's why, at this point, I think I'm not embarrassed to say I think the word head in Greek does at times refer to authority. And in this context, it makes perfect sense that that would be the case. Second point I want to make in this context is that like in Colossians, just as we find in Colossians, we have this connection between three different groups that Paul talks to. He talks to husbands and wives, he talks to masters and servants, and he talks to parents and children. And in each situation, he describes that he wants the person who is being asked to submit to the one who has some certain kind of authority in the relationship to do so with a good spirit, to do so out of a sense that this is what God is calling them to do. And likewise, he speaks to the person who has the position of authority and tells them not to abuse it, and basically that they are called in that situation not to be people who tell people what to do, but to be people who look out for the people that they have authority over. So mutual love and concern, mutual respect, but he does, in these three situations, call for one of the parties to submit to the other. He is not telling parents to obey their children. He's telling children to obey their parents. And then he's telling parents not to abuse the situation that they're in. So I think I'm convinced at this point that Ephesians and Colossians, those passages really do represent Paul saying that in these situations, for different reasons, a parent-child relationship is one kind of relationship, a master-servant relationship is another, and a husband and wife relationship is a third. There are different reasons in each of these cases why there is a certain authority invested in the other party. But in each case, it is appropriate and right for the person who is being asked to submit to do so with a good spirit. And for the person who has the authority in this situation to use it for the sake of the other person, not for themselves. That's what Paul is calling them to. A mutual concern for each other in the context of an authority relationship. Okay. But why? We can understand why parents and children would have that kind of relationship. We have more trouble understanding the master-servant relationship because we don't even know exactly what to think about the concept of slavery in that culture. Are we thinking more employer-employee, or is this brutal oppressor kidnapper? I mean, how are we thinking about the relationship between master and servant? And it's hard to even know where to go with that, and that's a big topic. But when we come to the question of husband and wife, the question is, how did Paul come to this place where he would say that there is any sense in which the wife ought to submit to the husband in this way? What grounds does he have for saying that that's the case? Well, that is not an easy question, but I think the best way to understand it, what I think is the most significant passage for understanding that question, is the very difficult passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. So that's the other one that I wanted to talk to you about. Now, this is tough. This is a tough passage, but a couple of things I want to say to you. Let me read it to you first. Starting in verse 2 of chapter 11. Now I praise you because you remember me in everything and hold firmly to the traditions just as I delivered them to you. But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ. Every man who has something on his head while praying or prophesying disgraces his head. But every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head. For she is one and the same with her whose head is shaved. For if a woman does not cover her head, let her also have her hair cut off. But if it is disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. For man does not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake. Therefore the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. However, in the Lord, neither is woman independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as the woman originates from the man, so also the man has his birth through the woman, and all things originate from God. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with head uncovered? Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him, but if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering. But if one is inclined to be contentious, we have no other practice, nor have the churches of God. It would be hard to find a section of Paul's letters that is more packed with hotly debated questions as to what almost every single sentence in this means. Probably every single sentence. I already talked about wallpapering your house, but if you have a separate garage or something that you're looking to wallpaper, then this one would be good. And I can't even begin to sort out for you all of the questions that people try to go into here. But there's a couple of things that I want to, points that I want to make. Because I did say, you heard me say that I think that this very difficult passage has a very important thing to say about the issue that we're talking about. First of all, right now, my understanding of what's happening in this passage, that the basic issue is something like this. That in this culture, it is a relatively new thing. You have Jews and Gentiles coming together here to worship together, which has not been the case before. And you have men and women worshiping together in a way that has not been the case before. I understand the situation to be that it was a culturally respected practice that men who had things on their heads, often when they were out in public, when praying to God to show a sign of respect to God, would uncover their head. So now here we have women in this situation, but the problem is that the cultural signals are mixed. Because for a woman to uncover her head in this situation would be a sign of disrespect to her husband. It would be understood in some sense that she was declaring herself to be free of him or something like that. And yet at the same time, the woman wants to show respect to God when she is praying, the same way that the men are showing respect to God when they pray. So my understanding, now, is this a debatable assertion, what I'm saying here? Yes, it is. Like I say, we could spend all night going over all these verses and the various things involved with it. But right now, that's how I understand how this works. And if that's the case, then, first of all, the message of this passage is not that all women in all cultures everywhere ought to have their heads covered when they go to church, but rather, in a cultural situation where taking something off of your head is a signal of disrespect to your husband, you shouldn't do it. What Paul is ruling on here is basically, don't worry, God can take care of himself. But what is inappropriate in this situation is for the women to conduct themselves in such a way that they are essentially declaring themselves to be free of their obligation to their husband. Now, there was a lot of weird stuff going on in Corinth, and a lot of weird ideas floating around about marriage and sexuality. And so, who knows what kind of weird stuff this had all turned into. I mean, this is a wild place, Corinth. What Paul is saying, though, is, as I understand it, look, there is something appropriate about you as a wife acknowledging the role that you have, the place that you have in relationship to your husband. And therefore, I don't want you to show disrespect to that by removing your head covering when you pray. I want you to keep it on. That's what I understand him to be saying. Not because he's so concerned about head coverings in and of themselves, but because in this cultural setting, the message that it sends to remove the head covering is a bad one. Now, he defends... Okay, that's my first point. That's what I think is happening in the passage. Many, many questions in here, though, but that's what I think is happening. Now, he appeals to Genesis in the midst of this, and this is the part that I think is important. He appeals to Genesis, and what I would argue he's saying is not Genesis says that you ought to have something on your head. Genesis indicates that there is a prior responsibility, a prior authority that goes to the man in relationship to his wife. And therefore, it is inappropriate for a woman to essentially fight that, to indicate to the world that she's not interested in that relationship. There's something wrong in doing that. So his appeal to Genesis is to say, look, you should not be disgracing your husband in this way. Because, as he says, man does not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed, man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake. There's blood all over those verses. There's so much fighting has gone on over those. You can hear the bitter sarcasm that some feminists have brought to this passage. Oh, so if you're created first, that means you're the authority, huh? So that, I assume then, that means that, like the rocks, they have authority over Adam, right? Or the giraffes, because they were created first. So Adam gets to tell Eve what to do, and the giraffes get to tell Adam what to do, right? So that's an interesting point to raise. What in the world is Paul talking about? Why does being created first have anything to do with it? I mean, what possible reason does that have in terms of what he's arguing for here? Well, I think the two phrases go together. He was created first, and in conjunction with that, he says, man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake. Now, obviously, I think if we look at the full picture, there is a sense in which the man was created for the woman's sake. There is a mutuality in the relationship between man and woman. And I don't think that Paul means to suggest that it's all on one side, that it's all for the benefit of the man. The man gets all the benefit and the woman does all the benefiting. That's not his argument. And if it were, I think that would be a very bad argument to be making. It's not a biblical argument to be making, I don't think. But what does he mean, the woman was created for the sake of the man? What is he getting at? My understanding of what he's getting at there, it arises from the equally controversial passage that says, it's not good for a man to be alone. I am going to create a helper suitable for him. And I think what Paul is arguing from Genesis, cryptically, but basically saying, look at the situation. Adam is created first. He is given a certain responsibility to take care of the garden, to rule over creation, in essence. He names the animals. He goes through this stuff. And then God says, I am going to create a helper suitable for him. What Paul is getting at is there is something significant to the fact that it wasn't the other way around. That it is not true. Adam was not created to be a helper for Eve. He was created to be a lot of things for Eve, but he was not created to be her helper. She was created to be his, I think is what Paul is saying. Therefore, that's what he means by saying she was created for his sake, not him for her. Now, you understand, in lots of ways they were created for each other's sake. But in this sense, she was created for his. Now, we can go into all of that stuff. Does help or... Well, actually, I will. Never mind about that. Okay, so... The idea being then, I think, that implicit in this picture, it's very... I mean, not a lot of detail is given us, but basically the picture emerges that there is a responsibility for which Adam is the one with the primary responsibility, ultimately is going to be answerable, and Eve has the task of working with Adam so that together they can fulfill this responsibility. But ultimately, the responsibility for it is his. He's responsible for his choices, she's responsible for hers, but he is responsible for this task that has been given. I think that's what Paul sees as the grounds for the headship that he is describing. The responsibility goes to Adam, therefore she's answerable to his having this responsibility in some sense. And I think it's very interesting, to say the least, that in the story in Genesis, we all know that it is Eve who ate of the fruit first. But in the New Testament, when we talk about the fall of man, who is it that gets the rap? It's Adam. Because ultimately, even though Eve was the first one to do it, that this project was Adam's responsibility. So the fact that it went the way it did is ultimately something that he's accountable for. That's what I understand the biblical picture to be. Now, oh goodness gracious. Okay, so lots of things to talk about there. You're going to say, but Ron, what about that stuff about her hair? And yeah, I know. But that's all I wanted to say at this point is these are the kinds of passages that I think give us some sort of sense for what is being talked about. That there is some sort of a prior responsibility that rests with the man. Now, from here on, though, what I want to do is to work with this idea and clarify it. Because by itself, we don't have nearly enough to think about what the implications of this are. Okay. We're under that idea. I've said, okay, everyone bears personal responsibility for their own choices. And then there are those situations where someone has a responsibility for the group or the overall direction of things. And the person who's responsible is the one who ought to ultimately get to make the decisions. Now, the fact is, however, that there are great limitations on what sort of obedience one with authority can rightly ask for. And this is important for us to understand, I think. First of all, authority is limited specifically to the areas that the one in authority is responsible for. This is a very, very important distinction. This does not eliminate the individual responsibility of each person. A supervisor cannot tell an employee how to vote in the national elections because that's not his responsibility. His responsibility is to make this project work in the work environment. He has no responsibility. He is not answerable for how the employee votes. The employee is answerable for how he votes. So he's got no business telling him anything about that. He has no right to say anything about that. It seems to me that this is a mistake that some Christian groups have made when it comes to the idea of obey your leaders, like from Hebrews. That we know of many authoritarian Christian groups where I would say the problem with them is that the leaders, the elders, the pastors have taken upon themselves responsibilities that are not theirs. God did not give the leadership the responsibility for the personal choices of the people in their congregation. It's not my responsibility who you marry or even what you believe. It's my responsibility what you hear in our church, but it's not my responsibility what you believe and what you go choose to do with that. That's your responsibility for your own life. So any anyone in authority who presumes to take upon themselves to tell people to what to do in areas that they do not have any responsibility for, they have in fact overstepped their bounds, and the person has no moral obligation to submit to that. And I think the same thing is true in marriage. Marriage does not give the husband the right to tell the wife what to do. The situation is the wife is recognizing that the husband has a responsibility before God, that he is answerable ultimately for the life of the family. So what she is submitting to, she's recognizing that he has this responsibility and she wants to make it possible for him to fulfill it. Options is wrong and destructive for our family, and I cannot in good conscience let us go in that direction. I think they've talked about it, the wife has explained her position, the husband has explained his position, and yet they come to this place where he says, I cannot in good conscience have us go in this direction. I think that's the kind of situation where the wife is acknowledging, okay, ultimately you're responsible for this, and that's where it would be appropriate for her to submit, say, okay. Even there, though, in a minute I want to qualify that, because even that's too simplistic a way to put it. But at least in that situation, we recognize that's something that's within the bounds of what is ultimately the responsibility of the husband in that situation, at least as I would understand it. And so it makes sense that he might ask something like that in that situation. But there's an awful lot in life that is just not the husband's business to ask for. And in fact, the same thing is true, I think, in parenting and all kinds of different situations. We so often use the theoretical context that I have some sort of authority to in fact use it to get what I want, which is exactly, that's not at all what the issue is. Another limitation that is put on the concept of obedience to an authority is it is limited by the requirements under which the authority must live. What I'm saying is, if someone has the responsibility for something and yet they're not trying to fulfill that responsibility, if a supervisor is using his or her position to defraud and embezzle the company, then that person has lost the right to expect obedience from other employees. It's not just because I'm the supervisor, you have to do what I say. It's rather, I have the responsibility for this project, which is why you're submitting to me. But if I have abandoned any pretext of actually trying to fulfill my responsibility, then I have abandoned any right to ask anybody to follow me. So once again, having authority doesn't mean you have to do what I say. It means I'm responsible for how this project turns out. So I have the moral right to ask you to submit to my decisions concerning this project, but an authority who has no interest in fulfilling those responsibilities has lost the right to ask that. That can happen in a church. It can happen in the marriage situation. I often hear objections to the concept of headship, something like, so if the husband wants to beat her up, she should just submit and let him, huh? Well, no. Because there's no way that he could make any sort of a case that he is fulfilling his God-given responsibility to his family. I mean, he's just doing what he wants. What he's doing is wrong. It's not done out of a desire to fulfill his responsibility before God. It's done out of anger. It's done out of whatever, you know, leads him to do a thing like that. There's nothing about it that calls for submission. That is, there's nothing about it that says, I have some sort of responsibility to submit to that. Because that's not what submission is based in. It is not just do whatever anybody tells you. It is rather recognize the responsibility of the person who has the responsibility. But if they're not being responsible, then that's not your fault. Okay, there's another qualification I think that we need to make about authority. Because we human beings are very interested in gaining power and prestige. And you know what I'm talking about. Each of us is, we like being in control. We like being the person that is seen as the one in control. I mean, there, how much of life is spent jockeying for position? All of us. I mean, we do this all the time. Because of this, we are inclined to associate ideas with authority that do not belong there. For example, authority does not imply superiority. We would like to think it does. If I'm the one who's got the title, then that means I'm better. But, I mean, if we think about it for a minute, it's not hard to see that that's not the case. Of course it's not true if we're talking about basic human dignity and worth. There is no human being who is intrinsically more valuable, more worthy of love or consideration as a creature of God made in His image. No one who is more worthy than anybody else. We all stand equally as God's creatures, deserving, equally deserving or not deserving of love and consideration. But it goes beyond that. Authority does not necessarily imply superiority in a lot of different ways. It doesn't necessarily imply superiority in skill or intelligence or whatever. Many supervisors who manage employees are managing people who are better at the tasks involved in the responsibility than they are. And they recognize it. In the church situation, we make a big mistake to think that somehow the life of the church is all about the pastor and the leadership doing their thing. And the fact is that a mature Christian leadership ought to recognize that the ministries of the people involved in the congregation, how they are interacting with each other and helping each other and so on, can be more valuable than what is happening from the pulpit or in the, or from the leadership itself. Leadership does not imply I'm the one who does it all. I'm the one who has all the answers. I'm the one who has all the skills. That's not, it's about responsibility. Likewise, I think in marriage we would be wrong to think that the husband, because of the responsibility that I think he has, is a superior person to the wife. Sometimes I get nervous. I know what people mean, but I hear this language that the husband is responsible to provide spiritual leadership in the home. And that's fine as far as it goes. I mean, I like that idea, except that that language can sort of sound like what we're saying, that is that the spiritual husband is leading the unspiritual wife. That somehow men by nature are more spiritual than women, and that's why God gave them the leadership so that they could spiritually lead their poor unspiritual wives. But I don't think that's implied at all in the picture that we're talking about. The wife has just as much responsibility before God to be a spiritual person as the husband does. And in her fulfilling her responsibilities and role in life can be just as, even more, spiritual than her husband is. There's nothing about the situation that God has set up here that implies that men are spiritually superior to women and that's why they're in charge. The fact is, now, I say this with great sincerity. What I'm about to say, I don't mean this to be condescending or anything like that. I hope nobody takes it in that sense, because I mean what I'm about to say with great sincerity from the bottom of my heart, that after almost 25 years of marriage, I know without a doubt that my wife is superior to me in many ways. I mean, I think when I first got married, I might have had a little bit of a chauvinistic sort of, you know, isn't she lucky to have somebody like me around to show her the way things are? But by the grace of God, I've had my eyes open for the past 25 years, and I just cannot pretend that it is the case that I'm the one that has the corner on the market in our relationship on wisdom or skill or intelligence or perception or anything like that. I mean, We each have our strengths and weaknesses that we contribute to this. And it's not that I am some sort of better person than she is. It's just not true. So I'm just not, I cannot be convinced by any sort of argument that would say that male headship arises from the fact that men are superior to women and ought to be in that position because of their superiority, because I don't believe it. I know my wife. I've known a lot of women. It's just not true. I mean, there comes a point at which experience has to tell us something. And I've just lived too long to be convinced that there is an inherent superiority of men over women. It just doesn't work. Now, I know it might sound, oh, it's so gracious of you, Ron, to admit that women are as good as you are. I don't mean it that way. I honestly mean that I think we need to take on that perception, that if we think that headship implies the superiority of men, then we have misunderstood the concept of headship, I think. Okay. It also doesn't imply that the responsible person tells everyone what to do. If you look in the work environment, oftentimes the best managers recognize that the people working for them know better than they do. A good manager will often put decisions in the hands of the people underneath him because they know the situation better than he does. What he's saying is, I will take responsibility for this. I'm willing for you to make this decision because I trust you. And I'm willing to take the rap for it. I know it's my responsibility ultimately how this works. That's why I'm listening to you, because I think you know what you're talking about. So, it doesn't mean leadership and headship, and what we're saying here, does not mean that the person who has the responsibility tells everybody else what they ought to do. It means that that's the person who has the ultimate responsibility. But how do you fulfill that responsibility? You fulfill it by working with the people that you're working with, drawing on their strengths, and serving them, which is ultimately the Christian model. I think Christian leadership is meant to be the same way. I mean, we have the great teaching of Jesus. Jesus called his disciples to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not so among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." The best leadership is based on the idea of serving the community that I have a responsibility for. Taking responsibility to see that the community has its needs met and that what is supposed to be happening is happening. Which may mean giving key roles to people who are not me. I see this mistake being made, it's what seems to me to be a mistake, a very serious mistake, regarding the concept of headship in marriage. I know situations where people demand, a husband demands that his wife get his permission before any decisions are made. And that's their understanding of what the notion of headship is about. Headship doesn't say, I get to make all of the decisions. Headship says, I ultimately have responsibility for this family. I know, in my relationship with my wife, that my wife is better at making some kinds of decisions than I am. If I were to make the decision on my own, I would make a poor one. And it isn't until her input comes into it that I recognize, this that was a much better way to go. And therefore, in our relationship, it seems foolish of me. I don't ask her to come and check with me before she makes decisions. We trust each other. We make the decisions that are in our arena in our relationship, and we trust each other to recognize that if there's a difficult and controversial decision to be made, then we need to talk to each other and sort it out. But of course I trust her to decide things without me saying what's going on. The issue is, am I willing to take responsibility for her decisions? Yes, I am, because I trust her and we're in this thing together. And do I trust that she will in turn respect the situation that I'm in and help me sort things out when we have difficult decisions to make? Yes, I do. So when it comes to, I said I wanted to talk about that homeschooling question again. The picture I was painting before was the husband is convinced, I cannot in good conscience support this direction. That seems to me to be a wrong, hurtful, destructive thing to do. And so the wife is submitting to the fact that he's responsible in that situation. But it seems to me that more often, like with the homeschooling decision, more often the situation is that there are pros and cons on both sides, and I have my perspective, I think it's like this, but I also recognize that there are arguments on the other side. And there have been times in my relationship, I'm just telling you how I understand this, showing you how I try to live this out, where I am of the opinion that we should do this, but I end up deferring to my wife's opinion that we do it the other way. Why? Because I'm not the head of the house, I'm abdicating responsibility to her? No. Because I recognize in this situation that it is a tough call, what it is we're going to do, and I think that given the situation, that it would be appropriate for me to show support of her, to say, okay, well, let's try it the way you think that it ought to be done. And let's, I can see that there are some arguments on that side, and I'm not so settled in my mind that it has to be the other way. I mean, I can see it. So my responsibility doesn't mean that I get to win. It means I take responsibility for what's happening. So I take responsibility. We will go your direction and see how it works out. That seems to me to be entirely within the bounds of what a biblical model of leadership would be all about. Okay. So, when you put it all together, the bottom line for this kind of thing is responsibility implies authority. As a husband and wife try to work out their relationship, and the question arises about this stuff, it's what we're trying to understand is what is the responsibility that each person has individually and what the husband may have for the family as a whole. Very briefly, I want to mention two other reasons why I might defer to someone. First of all, I ought to defer to anyone. If I'm thinking I want to do this, and someone comes along and points out to me, you're wrong. God, you know, you think that having an affair with your neighbor would be a fulfilling thing to do, but I'm telling you, this is not what God wants to happen. This is immoral, destructive for your family, and so on. It doesn't matter who says that. It doesn't matter whether I'm a boss and my employee says that. It doesn't matter whether I'm the husband and my wife says that, or I'm the father and my kid says that. The fact that I have authority doesn't change the fact that in that situation, they're appealing to the truth. And I have an obligation to submit to the truth. So anyone who says to me, you're wrong, I need to take seriously what they're saying and submit to what it is they have to say if indeed I recognize that they're right. I have been in the wrong. No amount of prior authority or anything like that has anything to do with that. Anyone can say that to anyone else. And then finally, the final reason why I might defer to someone is basically, you can just put it in a word, love. There are those situations where the person who is asking me to do something has no right to ask. I have no obligation to do what they have asked. Maybe the person is asking something unreasonable. Maybe the person is asking something that is even going to be not beneficial to me. I mean, the classic example of it is what Jesus says, "But I say to you, do not resist him who is evil, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. And whoever shall force you to go 1 mile, go with him too." Here, the person who's trying to force me to go a mile with them, and the situation he's describing is probably something like somebody coming along, the army or some rich person or something, that says, "Here, I need you to carry this for me. You know, I live a mile away, but I don't want to carry it myself, so you have to carry it. Something where somebody's compelling you to do something against your will. I think what Jesus is saying to us is, you do the amazing thing of, don't just go 1 mile with them, go two. The first mile, the mile they made you do, you ask themselves, why did they do it? Well, it's because I made them. But when you go the second mile, now the question arises, well, why did you do that? And it raises this interesting picture of, even though I unjustly compelled you to do something that you didn't have to do, you still freely chose to do something of benefit to me. I think this is what Peter is getting at in the famous passage in 1 Peter 3, where he talks about submission to a husband. There, in that passage, the issue is submitting to unrighteous people. Servants submitting to unrighteous masters. Citizens submitting to rulers who are unrighteous. And here we have a Christian wife submitting to a husband who is not a believer, and presumably not treating her the way she would like to be treated. And what Peter is saying is there, as I understand it, is not he has the right to expect such submission from you, but rather you're going to freely choose to do it for his sake. To try to, by your attitude towards him, convince him to take you seriously and to consider the faith that has led you to do that. So you're doing it for his sake. Okay. So, here's the deal. Each individual basically has the responsibility for their own life. Sometimes we might choose out of love to give up what is our right, what we would want to do, in order to benefit somebody else. Because we are motivated by the ethic of love and because we trust God that He is going to take care of us and that He wants us to do something for the other person. That's something that can happen in any direction. It has nothing to do with who's got authority and who doesn't. A wife can take that attitude towards her husband. A husband can take that attitude towards his wife. Child to parent, master to slave, whatever direction. The issue is just, I choose to give up something that I have the right to keep because I'm doing it for your sake. Secondly, I can defer to someone else because I recognize that even though I wanted to go that way, they're right. That's wrong. That's not the right way to go. And again, I can listen to someone, whether it's husband to wife, wife to husband. Again, it has nothing to do with authority relationships. It's just a question of what is true. Finally then, I believe at this point, we also have the concept that there are certain situations where besides the individual authority for your own life, there are people who have responsibility, like a pastor for a church group, or I believe God is saying that the husband in the family situation has a responsibility for the life of the family as a whole, not the individual choices of the family members, but the direction that that family goes as a whole. That responsibility is there, and therefore, it's appropriate for the wife to recognize that responsibility and submit to it, recognizing at the same time, though, that there are great limitations on that. That does not mean sanctioning abuse. It doesn't mean the husband gets to do whatever he wants. What it means is that two people together, both trying to submit their lives to God, are recognizing at a certain point that the husband has a responsibility and are trying to help him fulfill it. That's the picture as I understand it. And I went a little long, and I'm sorry about that. But actually, I could have gone a lot longer. So you should be grateful. Okay, so there's a microphone that will come to you if you have a question or a comment.
I'm really curious about the issue of spiritual headship or spiritual leadership, because I've heard it so much. Like, do you think that people get that from the idea that if you, like, because the husband is responsible for the group, that they should be the driving force behind the spirituality of the family or something like that? Could you talk more about that?
Yeah. Well, I think the right part of that perception is that the most important part of the life of a family would have to do with the moral and spiritual life of that family. I mean, if I've taken my responsibility to the family to mean that, you know, I've put food on the table, but I have in the process led my family to disregard the things of God or to be a selfish group of people who don't care about loving my neighbors myself, or I'm not concerned to know God better or follow God or something like that, then I have fulfilled my responsibility poorly. The family has not gone in a good direction, and I bear a responsibility that I have not tried to foster that. So in that sense, I think it is a right perception. But I come back to the idea that ultimately it's wrong of me to think that I am the fountain of spirituality for the group. That it is just as likely, I mean, it is often the case that in a family situation that many of the spiritual values of the family come from the mother. I mean, that's not at all an uncommon thing to do. And many children would say that their lives have been, their perception on how to treat people and how to live before God and so on have been just as much and maybe more so influenced by their mother as by their father. So in what I was trying to say is that the fact that the man has a responsibility, that together they are trying to take their family in a direction that pursues wisdom and righteousness and submission to God and all of that stuff, that right thing does not imply that the man is the fountain of all spiritual wisdom and so on. Then secondly, I will say, and this is probably controversial, and some of you won't like this, what I'm going to say, but probably some of you haven't liked what I said already, so that's okay. The passage I read in Ephesians, many people actually, take that passage when it talks about Christ loving the church and all of that stuff. I think they take the analogy too far. I think the analogy that Paul is making is that just as Christ sacrificed himself for the church, gave of himself, it cost him a great deal to sanctify the church. How did we get end up being washed, as he described it? It's through the sacrifice of his life. It's his blood on the cross that led to our salvation. And that's the model of leadership that he's urging the husband to. I mean, we're talking about taking care of my wife as if she were my own body and sacrificing myself for her and all of that sort of thing. Some people take that as if Paul is saying that just as Christ is responsible for the salvation of the church, the husband is responsible for the salvation of his wife. That he's the priest who sanctifies her and so forth in some sense in the family. And I don't think that's Paul's point. I don't think he is suggesting that there is any sense in which the husband to the wife is what Christ is to us in terms of what he accomplishes. I am not washing my wife and sanctifying her and all of that kind of stuff. I don't think he's saying. What he is saying, though, is this great and wonderful thing that Christ did for us, he did at great sacrifice to himself. And that's the model that the husband would have as a leader. If he has responsibility, he exercises that leadership by sacrificing himself. So maybe that idea comes from that passage, and at this point I'm not convinced that's a good way to take it.
Ron? It seems like when we're talking about Genesis and describing headship, like a sort of a version of headship within the garden between Adam and Eve, you're talking about like the helper thing.
Right.
It seems like headship isn't really described until the fall. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like that the relationship between a man and a woman, like Adam and Eve, and that headship thing is really described in this curse that God gives us.
Right. No, I'm seeing it very differently. I'm seeing there being two separate issues. Headship, as Paul is appealing to it in 1 Corinthians, he's appealing to the pre-fall assertion of God that he's going to make woman to be a helper for Adam. So, I mean, maybe I'm misunderstanding Paul and what he's getting at, but right now what I understand him to be saying is, before the fall, look at what God did. He made Adam, he gave him responsibility, and then he made Eve to be his helper. That's the grounds for headship as Paul is describing it. Then we have the curse, which I do tend to agree the language, your desire will be for your husband, but he will rule over you, that language, that it is describing, I think, a conflict that arises out of the fall, that that in essence, one of the implications of the fall is the battle between the sexes and the desire to overcome the man's dominance on the one hand and the man being dominant on the other hand, both of them, instead of in harmony, both of them working at cross purposes and that sort of thing. Something like that, I think, is what's being talked about. But that's not headship. That's an unpleasant reality that has arisen from the curse. Just as death and pain in childbirth and laboring to stay alive, all of that, all of these features of life as we know them are a result of the curse. But the idea that man and woman were created to have a certain relationship with each other and that there is a certain responsibility that the man has, that seems to me to arise prior. But that's the problem. I mean, what's hard for us to talk about with headship is that so easily and so often it turns into, we move from the idea of two people recognizing their obligation to each other to two people fighting for control. And then that has nothing to do with headship. Once you're at that spot, the fact that the husband has a prior responsibility is irrelevant. They are both sinfully seeking to get their own way at the expense of the other person, and headship has nothing to say at that point. What it says to both of them is, before we talk about who has the responsibility for the family before God, both of you cut it out. Okay, now let's talk about that's the responsibility. But you can't even go there. You can't even really talk about headship if selfish gain over the other person is what's driving the relationship to begin with, then you're already out of luck.
So is that what you were talking about, like the headship in the beginning, that was the sort of thing that you were like, we might as well just not call it that?
Right.
That was more of what you were just talking about, like at the fall?
Right.
Like that was...
Yeah, I'm talking about those sad situations where, you know, you're talking to people whose marriages are falling apart, and you're talking to a husband, and the wife is trying to get across to him that he has made any number of hurtful decisions, that he bears a certain responsibility for the state of things in the marriage. And the husband will not see it, will not admit that he has contributed anything to this situation, but he's got her because he's got a rule that says she's supposed to submit to him and she's not doing it. It's that idea that if you just take it and turn it into a rule without knowing why it's there, what it's for, and the sort of thing it's supposed to support, it becomes a terrible thing. I mean, you want to grab the husband in that kind of situation. You know, wake up! This is irrelevant. You're missing the point. I mean, you tell me how you've been screwing up for the past 20 years, and then we'll talk about who's supposed to be submitting to who. I mean, we've got more important things to talk about here before we do that. Yeah, so that's That's the kind of thing that I was saying, yeah. I would rather not believe in headship than believe in that kind of headship. That's just not it.
This, the passage about the woman submitting to the husband and the husband loving the wife.
Right.
It's always almost been more convenient to me to think of, been handy to have a woman's Bible and a guy's Bible. And the guy's Bible doesn't include the passages about the woman submitting to him.
Yes.
And the girl's Bible doesn't include the passages about the man dying for her, like Christ
right.
died for the church.
Right, right.
Because submission is the act of the woman. It's not a man demanding
right.
it.
Right.
It's not extracting that. And
right.
and the other reverse is true also of the man.
Right.
And so my sister-in-law is going through a divorce. And her husband's a Christian, so, you know, like you're talking about, demanding the headship and the respect.
Right. Right.
But it's more of a respect is something that needs to be earned as opposed to just a title
right.
that you wear.
Right. No, that's a very good point. That is a big mistake to take, I think, when it comes to the concept of headship. I mean, I can say I believe that this is the situation and this is what... Yeah, I believe I'm trying to fulfill my responsibility and this is what I think you should do. But it's not something I can demand. And the minute it becomes something I demand, then I am violating other things that I can't take stubbornness and self-centeredness and baptize it by putting headship on it. I mean, headship, that's why I say it has to go along with the more fundamental idea that I'm trying to obey God, I am seeking the welfare of the person that I'm dealing with here. I mean, I want to be willing to sacrifice everything if it could actually bring about something good for the person that I'm dealing with here, rather than that sense of, no, I gotta have my rights here. You're supposed to do what I say.
Let me say, first of all, I think this has been an absolutely masterful presentation. It's been very helpful, and you have negotiated this minefield seemingly with all your limbs intact.
Yeah, well, but we'll see.
Applaud you for that. I have a question that I hope doesn't just lead us right back into the minefield. And I know there's a lot of things that you can't cover, just too much material. But I had a question in regard to this matter of responsibility for our own decisions, certainly. But a seeming implication of responsibility on the part of those who have authority as well. And you mentioned Hebrews 13:17, where he says there, watch over your souls. He doesn't speak of it as the church body per se, but over your souls. And it seems as if when Paul speaks, like for instance in 2 Thessalonians 3, he says, if they're not following this pattern, then conduct yourself in this way toward them. In other words, make them follow the pattern that and obey the teaching that we have that we've given you here. And I'm just curious whether there isn't some sense, overarching sense, in which all of us being in a fallen state, the objective here is that we all come back to a place of entire submission under God according to truth. The problem is we don't know the truth. I mean, we are wandering around in the swamp trying to find the truth and figure that out. But Paul sets it in 2 Corinthians 10 as taking captive every thought to the obedience of Christ. And so is there not some... And I may just be not gathering this from what's been said, but is there not some sense in which in the role of authority... whoever has the role of authority has a responsibility to work to understand the truth in counsel, in fellowship, and so forth. But there is an obligation to say, no, but this is the path that we must walk in according to truth. And that may go beyond just a responsibility for the church as a whole down to an individual life, or for the family as a whole down to children and wife throughout the course of the whole family.
Like in Hebrews, when he talks about keeping watch over your souls, yes, I mean, the kind of submission he's calling them to is not just look, he's responsible to decide who brings the donuts, so you make sure that, you know, the right person brings the donuts or something like that. I don't think he's implying by that that ultimately, I mean, I have the responsibility, if I'm a leadership in a church situation, to look out for the souls of the people that are in the group, in the sense that, as you say, I mean, I try to understand the truth, I try to proclaim the truth, encourage us as a group to personally embrace the truth. As a group, I say, okay, we're not going to do this thing over here because that would not be in keeping with what we understand the truth to be. You know, we will do this thing because we think that's an important thing given what the Bible talks about and so on. So I don't think I meant to rule out anything like that. But what I'm saying is, where you can tell where someone has crossed over the line and become authoritarian in a bad sense, I think, is they are taking upon themselves to tell people what to do in a way that implies it's my responsibility to tell you, to make you do this. I think as a group, I can say, we as a group are going to be committed to this. And I'm calling you, I think this is true. And so, therefore, you should listen to what I'm saying. Is this not indeed what the Bible says? If it isn't, then come and tell me that it isn't what the Bible says, and we'll talk about it, and maybe you can convince me that I'm wrong about this. But if it is what the Bible says, then shouldn't we be about this? But ultimately, there's this place where I'm saying, for the group, this is what we're going to be about, and if you can't be about that with us, then you may have to go someplace else. But I'm still, it's your individual choice. I don't have the illusion that somehow that I can impose spirituality on you or actually do something to you. It's your choice that you have to make. And that means then that as I look at the more personal areas, I'm not going to tell you who to marry. If you ask me, you know, do you think this is a wise idea? Or maybe you're about to marry a non-Christian and I feel like I ought to talk to you about, have you thought about what you're doing here? And, you know, I think there's some stuff you haven't thought about. Sure, I'm going to counsel you. I'm going to talk to you about what I think is true. But it's not my place to say, I would say, it is not my responsibility to say, you should take that job instead of that job. You marry her. I know you don't know her, but I've had a word from God. You're supposed to be married to her. I would say that is authoritarian in a bad sense because it is not my job. I wasn't called to do that in that sense. I don't know if that speaks to what you said, but
it does. And I guess the question is where you end up drawing that line. Obviously, I couldn't know the truth to the extent that I could say that's the right person for you to marry. I mean, right. I don't have access to that kind
right.
of. But for instance, in the job situation that you mentioned, there wouldn't be authority to say you shall not take this job and move. However, where you see a pattern of a man following one dream after another and continually causing his family to suffer, you can say
right.
you are not being a godly husband, and this is what Scripture calls you to do.
Right.
And then you would speak, I think, with the authority of Scripture to watch over his soul. So, I mean, I guess
right.
it would be.
But I would take that. I mean, I would take that and put it in my second category that I was talking about. That if what I'm saying is the truth about the situation, it's not because I have authority as a pastor that you ought to listen to me, it's because it's the truth. If your buddy in the pew next to you says that very same thing about, look at this pattern of what you're doing to your family and stuff, you have just as much obligation to listen to him as you would to me.